So this is the course on conformal field theory. Let me start by telling you a few things about where you can find me, my name, and some useful references. So let me start with my name. It's Jaume Bamis. I'm a faculty member here at PI, and my office is 427, which is in the old part of the building. And so feel free to come and ask me any question whenever you are confused. But take advantage of, so for this course, we have three tutors. We have Anna, Eduardo, and Joel. So if they can, I'm sure they can answer all the questions, but if they cannot, of course, you're welcome to come and ask me. So unfortunately, there is not a very kind of canonical textbook that for this course on conformal field theory. So that makes my life more difficult because I have to collect different things from different places, from papers, and so on. But I'll mention in any case two useful references. One is a book titled Conformal Field Theory. It's a big yellow book. And the authors are DiFrancesco, Matthew, Senecal. And then there's some lecture notes, which is titled Applied Conformal Field Theory by Ginsberg and you can find them in the archives, so HEPTH 9108028. The downside of these textbooks, I mean, I think they're both nice. The downside is that their analysis focuses a lot on two-dimensional theories, while for the big, well, for, at least for the first third or a half of the course, we will be studying conformal field theories in arbitrary dimensions. And then later on, going down to two dimensions where kind of conformal field theories are most tractable. And these textbooks are mostly living in two dimensions. Okay. So, any questions about this? And if there is some particular reference that I find useful, I will mention it as I go along. So, one difficulty about this course, or perhaps something that's exciting about this course, is that it puts together many of the different things that you've learned so far. So, it uses general relativity, statistical physics, a lot of quantum field theory. So that's exciting. On the other hand, it may be a little bit hard because you have to understand all these things put together. And so it might be a little bit of a wild ride, but hopefully we all survive this. But in order for you to survive, please make sure that you stop me. Otherwise, I can go nuts. This never happens, but if you want me to go faster, let me know. That's never happened, actually. Never. Okay, so let's start. It is a lot of fun. So conformal field theory is a subject that has many, many applications. But before we can get into applications, and we will during the course, it's one of these subjects that first you have to develop some muscles and so that you are trained enough that you can actually get to the applications. And that's what we'll also do at the beginning of the course, to develop the muscles. And then we'll get to the applications. But before, I just don't want to start doing technicalities or the more formal aspect of the theory. First, I want to give you, like, from a broad perspective, why conformal field theory is an important subject. Why are you studying conformal field theory? Do you know? Well, I'll tell you today. And also tell you some of the many applications that conformal field theory has in theoretical physics, ranging from condensed matter physics to particle physics to quantum gravity. So today I'll give you just a kind of a general lecture that introduces some of the background for conformal field theory. If you don't follow all the details, don't get worried, because the goal of the course will be to fill in the details. But I thought it was useful that before we start, to give you a broad perspective on what the subject is and its scope. So what are conformal field theories? So these are quantum field theories. So these are a very basic definition. That have a very special symmetry that goes beyond the symmetry that you've been using in your field theory courses, which is Poincaré symmetry, or invariances under the Poincaré group. Conformal field theories are quantum field theories that are invariant, have a symmetry, which is conformal symmetry. And of course, I'll have to tell you what the conformal symmetry is. So conformal symmetries are generated by conformal transformations. Which are space-time transformations of the type where you take your space-time coordinates into x mu tilde that have the property, the remarkable property, that they preserve angles between vectors. Okay. But the thing that's important is that they preserve angles, but they do not necessarily preserve distances. So these are transformations that allow us to ask questions about what happens to a system when I probe it at some length scale L, and what happens to the system when I observe it from a new length scale, which is, say, lambda over L, where lambda is some real parameter. Okay. And conformal field theories are systems which have invariants under these transformations. And of course, among these transformations, it includes some of the ones that you already know very well that do preserve distances. Of course, a special class of transformations that have this property are Poincaré transformations. These ones are special among the set of conformal transformations of flat space in that on top of preserving the angle between vectors, they also preserve the norm of vectors. Because under a Poincaré transformation, let me just remind you, the Sharpe notation, you have a Lorentz transformation and a translation. Remember that this lambda mu nu is an antisymmetric d by d matrix. And under these transformations, by definition, the flat Minkowski metric is invariant. And therefore, not only you preserve the angles between vectors because you have not changed the metric, but furthermore, since you haven't changed the metric, you also preserve the distances. Okay. So any conformal transformation will include as a subsector a Poincaré transformation. So in a way, the question about conformal field theory is which theories of the standard type, of the relativistic quantum field theories that are by definition invariant under Poincaré transformations, have a further symmetry that preserve angles but not distances. Okay. So what is the simplest conformal transformation that's not a Poincaré transformation? And this is a scale transformation. So this is essentially a transformation that allows you to zoom in and out of a region and allows you to probe, ask the question of what happens to the system when I rescale it, essentially. So a scale transformation, it's clear what it does. It takes, and in general now, okay, so it rescales time in some particular way. where lambda is a real parameter. So you take time and you rescale it by some factor, lambda to the z. Z is what's called a dynamical exponent. And at the same time, you rescale your spatial coordinates like that, okay? And essentially, this z parameters measures how different the system scales in time with respect to spatial coordinates, okay? In this course, we're mostly going to be interested in relativistic quantum field theories. So that means that they're invariant under the Poincaré group. So for those theories, so for relativistic quantum field theories, the value of the dynamical exponent will be 1. Can someone tell me why? That's right, yes. I mean, a relativistic invariant theory treats space and time in the same manner, so you better scale space and time in the same way. Okay. So therefore, for relativistic field theories, I'll use mu to denote all the space-time coordinates, including time. Scale transformations will act like this, okay? So we scale all coordinates homogeneously by a constant factor lambda. Okay. But just for fun, I mean, can someone tell me what the dynamical exponent would be just for a free non-relativistic particle? So that will, there are several ways of saying it. Someone else maybe wants to try.
2.
Okay, so what?
Because in the energy equation, you have like a derivative of time and two derivatives of, well, you have momentum squared, this is two derivatives of space and one of time.
That's right. So okay, yeah, so very good. So there are two ways of saying it. One is by saying that if you look at the Schrodinger equation, just of a free non-relativistic particle, you can formulate in terms of a Lagrangian, where you have psi dagger equals I dt minus lambda square psi. This Lagrangian describes a free non-relativistic particle. It gives you the Schrodinger equation, that's the equations of motion, right? Clear that in order for the system to be invariant, since I have only one time derivative here and two special derivatives here, this guy has to scale twice as strongly as this one in order for this guy to be homogeneous. Okay. Another way of saying it is that you know that the dispersion relation, the relation between energy and momentum of a non-relativistic system, goes like, say, p squared. So it tells you that if I do a rescaling of energy and momenta, in order for this to be invariant, energy has to scale twice as fast as momentum does. Okay? So that's why in a non-relativistic system, in this particular non-relativistic system, z equals 2. You can construct other relativistic theories where z can take more exotic values. And we may come back to this in some of the exercises, but for most of the course, I will be focusing on relativistic scale invariant theories. Okay. So as I said, for the relativistic theory, I have to rescale all my coordinates homogeneously in this way. So if I take some region, it will zoom this region if lambda is bigger than 1 into a bigger region. In the same way, the momentum. So if I go to larger distances, it means the momentum will have to get smaller. So a scale transformation acts on momenta. This essentially is fixed by dimensional analysis. If x scales this way, momenta scales that way. Okay. And this enforces this picture that if you go to larger and larger distances, the momentum that of the mode that you need to prove the larger distance gets smaller. Good. This is the usual intuition that to probe short distances, you need high momenta, and vice versa. Okay. So this is the simplest example of a conformal transformation that's not kind of boring Poincaré transformation. And at least in dimensions bigger than 2, there is only one other type of transformation which we will construct, I guess, starting tomorrow or the day after tomorrow. So there is more to conformal transformations than Poincaré transformations and scale transformations. For the time being, I'll just mention that I will not write explicitly what this other transformation is. We will, of course, later on. But the basic idea, as I already said it there somewhere, that a conformal transformation has the property that it preserves angles between vectors. So a general conformal transformation would be some coordinate transformation like that, that has the property, since I want to preserve angles, the special part of the metric has to remain fixed, but the scale can change. So that means that here the scale, sorry, I didn't say this explicitly here, but if you make this transformation, of course, the original Minkowski metric gets rescaled by a factor of lambda squared. Because if I rescale the coordinates, I rescale the distance. And the more general conformal transformation is almost like a scale transformation, except that it doesn't need to be isotropic. It can depend on the space-time point I'm sitting at. So it can be of the type lambda square of x, eta mu. Okay. And of course, this kind of transformation that preserves a metric up to a scale is precisely what we mean by a transformation that preserves angles, because the metric has not changed, only the scale has changed, which is the statement that you only change the length scale, not the angles. Any questions about this? So one of the things that we will do soon is to just construct all possible space-time transformations that have this property. Okay. And we will see that in dimensions bigger than 2, there's a finite number of such independent transformations that you can have, a finite number of generators. Just like the Poincaré group, the Poincaré transformations have a finite number of generators. In 4 dimensions, there are 10 Poincaré transformations. We will see that, for example, in 4 dimensions, there are a total of 15 conformal generators. We will have the 10 Poincaré ones that you know and love. We'll have this generator of a scale transformation, which is usually called a dilatation. And then we'll have 4 extra that are called a special conformal. And that's it. In 2 dimensions, it turns out that there's an infinite dimensional space of conformal transformations. And that's behind the power that allows us to solve, in many cases, 2-dimensional conformal field theories exactly.
Excuse me?
Yes.
How did that P transform?
Sorry?
I mean, why did the momentum transform that way?
Essentially, this is just dimensional analysis.
Well,
if I rescale coordinates in one way, this has units of length, this has units of mass.
Yes.
Another way you can see it more explicitly, you can write down.
So how does mass scale?
Oppositely than coordinates. So, but another way to see more explicitly is that, maybe in order to explain it more explicitly, I would have to introduce some jargon that I want to postpone later, but let's come, when I discuss more in more detail how these symmetries are generated in terms of transformations, infinitesimal transformations, remind me and I'll tell you why momenta scales oppositely. Yes?
I'm sorry, I didn't understand how this general transformation is 0 to angle.
Because, okay, what is the angle? Essentially, I should give it as an exercise, but essentially, if you take 2 vectors and I compute the norm, I mean, the angle is essentially computing this. Now, if I, with this dot meaning that you're contracting things with the metric, right? If I make such a transformation and the metric changes in this way, essentially you get a power of lambda squared here, which is precisely cancelled by this factor of one lambda squared here, and you have the square root. Is that clear? Any more questions? Very good. So it turns out that some of the equations that, most beautiful equations in physics that you know and love, actually have the property that they're invariant under this nice set of transformations, the conformal transformations. So let me give you a few examples. So they're conformal invariant. And this alone is an important motivation to understand conformal transformations and the constraints that they put on the dynamics of a field theory. So the first one is Maxwell's equations. So Maxwell's equations, of course, are famously known to be Poincaré invariant, but it turns out they also invariant under the full conformal group. By the way, I mean, the like with any symmetry in physics, the set of transformations that generate a symmetry form a group. I think you've seen that a lot before this. So the set of all conformal transformations generates the, what's known as the conformal group. So Maxwell's equations is invariant under the conformal group. And let me remind you, this is this equation, the mu f mu equals 0. So it might not be obvious, and I think you will, I'll give you an exercise for you to demonstrate, for example, that this equation, apart from being invariant under Poincaré transformation, is also invariant under conformal transformations. Another important and beautiful equation that's conformal invariant is the Dirac equation, massless Dirac equation. So this is gamma mu is the usual Dirac gamma matrices. So let me remind you just to satisfy the Clifford algebra. Okay, and this equation is also conformal invariant. Another one that you've studied a lot with Francois is the classical lambda phi to the fourth theory in D equals 4. It has this equation of motion that the Lambertian on phi equals lambda over 3 factorial phi cubed. But here I want to stress the word classical. We'll come back to this because this will be a very important point. But the classical equations of motion are scale invariant. And finally, I mean, finally, no, because there's many other ones, but in terms of important ones, classical Young-Mills equations. Classical Young-Mills theory is also invariant under conformal transformation. So given that you saw this last week, I mean, can someone tell me what is more explicitly what this equation, how to write this equation? I mean, essentially I'm looking for the difference between this equation and that equation. The difference between electromagnetism and Young-Mills. Sorry?
At the term minus A mu.
Yes, okay, so, well, so more explicitly what you mean is? That's what you said, right?
Yeah.
Well, so the important point is that, well, this equation is linear in F. Of course, Young-Mills equations are much more interesting, precisely because they're non-linear equations. But nevertheless, they're non-linear, but still conformal invariant, classically. Notice that these theories that I've written down have the property, the common property, that they have no dimensionful parameters. They have no masses, no coupling constants that are dimensionful. Okay. But of course, because such, if you have a dimensionful parameter in the Lagrangian, this will not be invariant under a scale transformation. Okay. But you know, from if there is anything that you should have taken away from your field theory course, is that in quantum field theory, there are no coupling constants. The coupling constants depend on the energy scale. Okay, and that has to do with the fact that virtual processes conspire to make the coupling constants of your theory acquire a dependence on the energy scale of the process that you're studying. Okay. So that means that even though these two theories are classically conformal invariant, they are not quantum mechanically. And the reason is that, as I said, in the classical theory, coupling constants are constants, but in quantum theory, they're not. They depend on an energy scale. OK, so here, it depends on your convention, but you might want to put a G here. So these guys depend on an energy scale. And therefore, even though the theory had a classical symmetry, the quantum theory breaks that symmetry. So that the slogan that we have when a classical symmetry is broken by quantum effects is that the original symmetry is anomalous. So you have anomalous conformal symmetry. OK. So can someone remind me of how do we determine, or what are the equations that determine the energy dependence of the coupling constants in quantum field theory? That's, yes, the Calamity-Mansi equation, but yeah, and we'll write it down maybe later. But more precisely, the way you can just capture directly. So the Calamity-Mansi equation tells you something more than that. It tells you how the correlation functions change as you make a scale transformation. Just to see how the coupling constant dependence, there was this notion that you saw with Francois of the beta function. So to each coupling constant, you associate a beta function that precisely encodes this information. So the beta function of a given coupling constant G is the dependence of that coupling constant with respect, and this is just convenient, with respect to the logarithmic derivative of the energy. Okay. So if the theory has a non-trivial beta function, and most vanilla theories have a non-trivial beta function, it tells you that the coupling constant depends non-trivially on the energy scale, and therefore the theory will be conformal symmetry will be anomalous. There are very interesting theories where, and you will study them later in the Psi year, that have the remarkable property that the beta function vanishes exactly. So they're exact conformal field theories, and the simplest example of that, the most symmetric example would be that you will study in the ADS-CFT course. An example of a theory that will really be not only classically, but exactly quantum mechanically conformal will be a four-dimensional. This is the simplest four-dimensional quantum field theory that you can have, which is four-dimensional equals four super young Mills. Doesn't matter what this calligraphic n equals four means. It essentially tells you that apart from having this fancy conformal symmetry has yet a more fancy supersymmetry. And this is an example of a theory that's exactly conformal. But most theories, like QCD, have an anomalous dependence on the energy, and therefore are not quantum mechanically conformal invariant. Okay? So at this point, you might ask, why am I wasting your time if you know QCD is not conformal invariant? So what I want to tell you now is that despite the fact that most physical theories, in fact, but even though there are many that will be conformal invariant, and we will use them very heavily in the second part of the course for applications to condensed matter physics and statistical mechanics, but it's natural to wonder if these are kind of very special theories in which the beta function vanishes, why do we care about them? Okay. And what I want to give you a flavor now is that conformal field theories are central to our understanding of even non-conformal field theories, of relativistic field theories, okay? So now I'll make a little digression about quantum field theories, about renormalization group flow, and how conformal field theories fit in the space of all quantum field theories, and how all quantum field theories can be thought of as deformations of conformal field theories. So in some sense, the conformal field theories in the space of all field theories, in some sense, it's what's holding the space of all field theories together. And you can think of any field theory that you want, like classical, I mean, like Young-Mills theory, QCD, as a perturbation by a relevant operator of a conformal field theory. And this is a very useful way of thinking about the space of field theories. So even though you might be interested, not interested in a theory that's conformal invariant, any such theory can be thought of as arising by some perturbation, a relevant deformation of a conformal field theory. So it's a very useful starting point to think about the space of field theories. Okay. So as I said, so crucial to our understanding of all quantum field theories. And of course, quantum field theories are remarkable things. This is an example, perhaps one of the best examples, of how starting with a very simple set of principles and ideas, they have an immense range of applications, ranging from high energy physics, condensed matter, hydrodynamics, whatever. Okay? But let's think a little bit more carefully what actually a quantum field theory is, or not. Before doing that, let's think more carefully of how do we really think of a physical system. So usually when you want to study a physical system, you have to decide what is the energy scale or the distance scale that you're interested in that system. So for example, if you're studying the hydrogen atom, depending on which energy scale you want to probe, you'll be able to just use the Schrödinger equation for an electron moving in the background of a nucleus. But if you're interested at much shorter distance scales, you have to take into account the fact that there is a proton and the proton has dynamic. And if you go even to shorter distances, you have to take into account the proton is made out of quarks. And if you're very ambitious and really want to go to very short distances, at some point you'll hit with the subtleties of quantum gravity. Okay? So whenever we tackle or try to understand a physical system, the first thing that we have to make precise is what is the energy scale, what is the size of the, what scales do I want to probe in that system? Because that will determine what is the most suitable description for that system, okay? For example, if you want to describe water in a bucket and you want to just study the waves there, it would be ridiculous to study it using QCD, because at the end of the day, water is made of protons and quarks and all of that. Instead, it's much more useful to use a hydrodynamic, because at those energy scales, this is the effect that's called effective description of the system. Okay. So as physicists, we always have to organize, we always organize our physics in terms of energy scales or length scales, and then we choose which description is more appropriate or not. Okay. The other thing that we have to remind ourselves about when we think about the quantum field theory, we have to be humble and realize that physical systems, the physical description comes equipped with a cutoff, lambda. So this is some energy scale above which we cannot claim we understand what's going on. Okay. And that always, at the very least, this energy scale, and of course, in a physically interesting system, there are many thresholds of energy scales at which new physics happens and the original description breaks down. For example, in the case I gave you about the hydrogen atom, the picture of an electron orbiting around the nucleus breaks down when you try to probe the energy scales of the probe the structure of the nucleus in terms of quarks. But At the very least, there is an energy scale for which we cannot claim that we know what happens in quantum field theory, which is the Planck scale, at the very least, where quantum gravity kicks in. We don't know whether space-time makes any sense. I'm writing a metric, you know, eta mu nu. We don't know if that makes any sense. So whenever we have a field theory, at least implicitly, we should always think that this is valid up to some energy scale. And above that, we don't know what's happening. But the thing that's remarkable about physics, and that's why we've been able to make progress in physics for the last millennia or so, even though we still not know very much about the Planck scale, is that in some sense, the complications of what's happening up there, very high energies, is not very important to study low energy processes. You can parameterize, I mean, one way of saying it is that we don't have a fundamental description of nature up to arbitrary short distances, but we can parameterize. So we have some, let me draw a picture. We have some energy scale of the order lambda, which we have no idea what's happening here. But we're interested here, okay? So I'm an experimentalist at very low energies. And here is the LHC at 1 TeV, or I don't know, relativistic ion, heavy ion collisions at scales of MeV, or in condensed matter, it would be below the first floor. The thing that's remarkable is that if we're interested in energies which are far below the cutoff scale here, we can still have a very good description of the physics here, even though we know nothing here, okay? And that's the basic idea of the renormalization group, okay? The normalization group of Wilson makes this intuition precise, okay? And so let me just tell you a little bit how to think about this. So essentially, if you want to study a physical system at very low energies, like a DLHC, there are several things that you know, that you need to know. One of them is what are the degrees of freedom. When I mean degrees of freedom, I mean the low energy degrees of freedom. I don't care about the high energy degrees of freedom. I don't know what they are in general. And you need to know about symmetries. Whether the system has a particular global symmetry, discrete or continuous, it depends. For example, for magnets, you could have a discrete Z2 symmetry that tells you that it's equally likely for spins or magnetization of a two-dimensional, say, magnet to be aligned up or down. Okay? So you have to input the degrees of freedom. So in that example would be like the magnetization. So you're interested in studying the magnetization at very low temperatures of a magnet. You're going to characterize this by a degree of freedom, which is going to be a scalar field. And you're going to impose that the magnet that you're studying has a certain symmetry, which is some discrete symmetry. So in that case, Z2. Under which, if I change the magnetization by a sign, the physics is invariant. And in this framework of the normalization group is that what you do is you write down the most general Lagrangian, which is consistent with the degrees of freedom that you think your system has and with the symmetries, okay? So you write something like this, S equals S naught. That's kind of the kinetic, yeah. So for this case, it would be like just the kinetic term that measures the fluctuations of your variables. And then you add all possible interactions. You write all possible interactions that you can construct out of your basic fields in your system that encode the degrees of freedom. And all these interactions with the only concern that these interactions will be invariant under the symmetries that you think your system has, okay? And you have to write all of them. So this is an infinite, this never stops. So this sum runs over all possible, in the case of phi, I could take phi to 100, phi to 1 million. So you have to add all of them, okay? Now, the thing that is amazing, so before saying that, so you would say that if we think in this way, this is hopeless because, you know, here I have a system that's described by an action that has an infinite number of parameters, these GIs, one per interaction that the system can have. And therefore, this is useless, even at low energies. But the thing that's amazing, and that allows us to make progress, being able to focus not on an infinite number of coupling constants, but on a finite number of coupling constants, is based on two basic ideas. One is dimensional analysis. And the second one, I mean, this is kind of intuitive, that the more precise formulation of why we can describe low energy physics using small sets of degrees of freedom and a small number of parameters is exactly the ideas of the renormalization group. Essentially, what this tells us is that at low energies, only a finite number of interactions, of interaction terms in this sum, are important. Okay? So even though we started with an infinite number of coupling constants, an infinite number of operators, these interactions sometimes are called operators, it's just a fact of dimensional analysis and improved dimensional the renormalization group should be thought of as a souped-up version of dimensional analysis. What this thinking along these lines essentially tells you that only a very few of those interactions are actually important, and therefore, if I'm a low-energy observer, I don't care about these other terms. Okay, so I can just focus my attention on a finite number of parameters. Okay, of course, since I don't know what's happening up here, I do not know how to calculate these parameters from first principles, because I don't know what the theory here is. But the beauty of physics is that we can still make progress, even though we don't know what's happening up there. And the way we make progress is in two steps. Once we have a low energy effective description, and that's what the buzzword is, this is the low energy effective field theory, low energy effective description. The first thing that we have to do is to fix the couplings at some energy scale by comparing to an experiment. So the downside of this approach is that you have to have an interplay, direct interplay between theory and experiment. You have to measure the coupling constants that are important low energies by comparing them to experiment. That fixes the coupling at some energy scale. But then the renormalization group equations, these beta function equations, tells you how the couplings change with the energy scale. And therefore, once you've made a set of measurements to fix the coupling constants, then you can extract predictions from it, because now you fix the couplings at one energy scale, and now you can compute arbitrary processes, and you can do an arbitrary experiments. And then the answers of those experiments predicted by the low energy physics is completely unambiguous, and they will match or not with the experiment. Okay? And that's how we've been able to make progress in physics in this way. Any questions about this? I mean, at some level, I hope you have seen some of these things with Francois, but if not, I don't think it will hurt to maybe hear it again. Probably in a different language. Okay. Is there something else I want to say? Okay, not for the time being. Okay. And by the way, today in the tutorial, one of the things that you will have to do is to, all this story I've been telling you, to make it precise by you developing an intuition about which, so given a set of fields or degrees of freedom, which interactions will be important at low energies, at high energies, and how to think of organizing your low energy description of a given physical system in terms of the relevant interactions at low energy. So if you still are confused about this by tomorrow, ask me, and then we can go in more detail. But hopefully this has been sufficiently clear. Okay. So now, where are the conformal field theories in this mess? So now we have to put together these two facts that we have this picture of how to describe low energy physics in terms of low energy effective Lagrangians, and the fact that in quantum mechanics induces on all coupling constants an energy dependent. Okay? So what this means is that in the space of quantum field theories, this is an indefinite dimensional space. This is not space-time, okay? This is the parameterization in the space of all interactions. There are flows. So these equations are kind of flow equations. And as you change the energy scale, these coupling constants experience a flow as you change the energy, okay? Which are precisely dictated by this. By the way, here to be more concrete, in this case, in general, the beta function is a very complicated system. So you'll have this depends on all of them. Sorry. Okay. So these are some flow equations that tell you how the coupling constants change as you change the energy scale. Okay. And now, the thing that's important for our purposes of studying conformal field theories is that the asymptotic behavior, generically, the asymptotic behavior of these flows, of these arc normalization group flows, are controlled by fixed points, by the fixed points of these flows of the normalization group flow. So what are the fixed points of this flow? These are precisely the locations where the right-hand side vanishes. Okay? So the fixed points are precisely where the values, and I call them G star, where this guy vanishes. Okay? So you have a picture of some flows. So let me just give you some pictures. So this, again, in the space of couplings. Here you have a fixed point where the beta function vanishes. And then emanating from this fixed point, now you have a dynamical system. You can have directions that are attractive or repulsive. Attractive away from the fixed point or towards the fixed point. Towards infrared, so going to lower and lower energies, which is typically what we want to do. You start at high energies and you want to go to lower and lower energies. And then essentially, according to how the different interactions behave near a fixed point, you arrive at the classification of the possible interactions that you can have in terms of its relevance at low energies. How should we do this? So we can classify interactions according to their behavior near a fixed point. Okay. One thing, of course, I should have, which was the key point, is that precisely the points where the beta function vanishes. Remember, these were precisely the points in which the theory, by definition, is a scale invariant, because the derivative with respect to the energy scale vanishes there. So at the fixed points, okay, this was important. So here, fixed points of RG are precisely corresponding to a scale invariant quantum filter. And that's the point. That's the critical point. That the asymptotic behavior of any flow in any field theory is dominated by scale invariant quantum field theories. And now there is one extra wrinkle. You might say that from what I described before, you can have a theory that's scale invariant but not conformal invariant. This is a point that's subtle, and actually it's a point of current interest in research in high energy theory. But and we will come back to this later, but essentially, for all reasonable assumptions, any theory that is scale invariant will be also conformal invariant. So that the fixed points of the normalization group are precisely the conformal field theories that we were describing. Okay? Now, in general, of course, these conformal field theories will not be a free conformal field theory, but will be some strongly interacting conformal field theory, because this guy, the coupling constant, will take some non-trivial value that solves these non-linear equations. Okay? So to summarize this statement, what I wanted to say here is that in the space of quantum field theories, you have renormalization group flow, that there are special points in the space of quantum field theories where you have fixed points. These fixed points are described, and these fixed ones are precisely conformal invariant quantum field theories, okay? Conformal field theories. And these fixed points completely determine the topology of this of the space of flows of quantum field theory. That's why that was the point there, why conformal field theories are crucial to our understanding of in the space of quantum field theory. Okay. Good. So now we can classify operators according to their behavior near a fixed point. So the names you know, hopefully. You can have relevant operators. These are directions that are flowing away, that flow away from the fixed point. And these are characterized by operators OI that have a dimension that's smaller than the space-time dimension, D, okay? And these are the operators that are called relevant, because these are the operators that dominate, completely dominate the low-energy physics. Remember that I said that arrow coming out of the, and this corresponds precisely to the directions that push you away from the fixed point, okay? So these are the interactions that become large and therefore dominate as you flow toward less distances. Then you have irrelevant. These are the ones that flow towards the fixed point. And the dimension is bigger than D. And therefore, the crucial point here is that these guys are not very important at large distances. And that's why we can do physics, because essentially the point is that even though we started with an infinite number of couplings and operators there, GI, OI, the point is that except a set of measures zero, all of those operators are irrelevant. There's only a finite number, given a set of degrees of freedom, there's a finite number of relevant operators. And therefore, if you're interested in large distance physics, which we are, you can ignore or this infinite tower of operators is not important. And we can just focus on the relevant ones. Okay? And then finally, you can also have a marginal operator, which preserves conformality. This is an operator . So this is when you have a theory that has not a critical point. So here I drew this as a point. There are systems where you have a line of conformal field theory. So there is an extra parameter. So you can have there's a line of conformal field theories where the theory is conformal in all this region. Okay, and the interaction that moves you from here to here is what's called a marginal deformation. So the theory is conformal anywhere between these two points. But it's rare to find marginal operators, even though there are many examples, especially in supersymmetric theories. Okay. Any questions about this? This you should be familiar with from quantum field theory, but if not, I'm happy to expand on it. Yes?
Can you explain what is this line? Why should it be a line?
Sorry?
This line is the space of parameters.
Yes.
Why should it be a line?
As opposed to?
What?
You're saying that, imagine you have an operator, and you're at a fixed point. And now I deform the theory by turning on an interaction. But it has, precisely because it has, here I didn't say that. Here, the importance is the dimension equals t. It has the property that even though I deform the theory from the original one in some direction, because there's a coupling constant associated to any operator, the theory is still conformal in that direction. So it just means that I start with a Lagrangian, I have an origin, and I moved it away from the origin by turning on some coupling constant. I moved in the space of coupling, but while preserving conformal symmetry. Maybe I don't understand the question.
I just thought that conformal field theory corresponds to one fixed point.
But it could be, what I'm saying is that for a special conformal field theory, it could be a fixed line.
Oh.
So you have you can have a very big space, and it could be a fixed submanifold. You could have there are examples of field theories that have a finite dimensional space of marginal operators, and then you have in the infinite dimensional space of couplings, there is a surface, and at any point of that surface, which is parameterized by the marginal coupling, the theory is conformal. Now here I chose an example in which I turn on some particular marginal operator, so I go from here to here. But it's the theory is conformal anywhere in this direction. Is that more clear? Yes. Okay.
Okay. Well, I have a question. Here, marginal, you mean that it stays marginal even after all the quantum correction?
Yes, exactly marginal. Yeah. So here, when I say delta, you should really have into mind the exact dimension. So you're used to the notion of a classical dimension of a field, just this just dimensional analysis. But just like the coupling constants acquire, are modified by quantum effects, the dimensions of operators are modified by quantum mechanics, and they're functions of h bar. And in fact, in one of the exercises, you will be computing the shift, the deviation away from the classical dimension due to quantum effects of some particular interaction. And you will see that the dimension is a dynamical thing, it's not that someone told you it's like for a scalar field, it's d minus 2 over 2. It's not God given. I mean, it has quantum corrections. And when I talk about this, I really have in mind the exact anomalous, the exact dimension of the operator, once you include all quantum corrections. Any more questions? Yes?
Yep. One question about a theory that sits at a fixed point. I see that it has gate invariance, so dilation invariance. But why does it also have invariance under special conformals?
Yeah, so that's what I said. So this, so in general, so let me say several things about this. In two dimensions, this has been rigorously proven, that if you have a theory that is scale invariant and unitary, it's automatically conformal invariant. In higher dimensions, we expect the same to be true, but there is no proof of it. And in fact, there are papers coming out now exactly trying to address this problem of, but if I had to bet any money, which I don't have, but if I did, I would bet that if a theory is unitary scaling variable, we conform an invariant. It just happens that we don't have a proof of it. People have searched for counterexamples, and whenever a counterexample has been found, there's a very serious pathology with the counterexample. For example, the theory will not be unitary and stuff like that. But I cannot make the claim that this has been proven. But this is, in all practical examples, this seems to be true. But in fact, it's a very important question in quantum field theory to establish this. And people are trying. And there has been progress in the last few months on this. People claim to have counterexamples, but OK, I'm in the corner, so I'm not going to say anything. My sense is they're pathological. But definitely, the vanishing of the beta function is a statement about scaling invariant, not conformal invariant. So here I'm making the extra assumption, very well motivated assumption, that if the theory is relativistic, unitary, and scaling invariant, that it will be conformal invariant. But in fact, in the second or third lecture, I will give a precise characterization of what does it mean for a theory to be scaling invariant and for a theory to be conformal invariant. And we'll see that the conditions are different. This one is stronger than this. But if you try to construct an example where you have this but not this, you fail. But the conditions are definitely, at least superficially, they look stronger for conformal invariants, of course, than for scaling invariants. Any more questions? Okay, so let me just summarize what the point here was. The point was that in the space of all quantum field theories, when all the dust settles, there are only a small number of operators that are important at low energies. These are the Riemann operators. And we can mostly ignore the Riemann operators unless you start probing energies closer at high energies where the effects of these Riemann operators start being more important. Okay. The fact that, barring our complete ignorance of what's happening at very high energies, the fact that we can just write down the most general interactions given a set of degrees of freedom that will be important at low energies motivates or gives a first principle understanding of something that has been observed in nature and in many condensed matter systems, which is the fact that you can have two very different looking physical systems, like a magnet near the Curie temperature and water near the liquid gas transition, that look completely different. I mean, they have nothing to do with each other, essentially. But that if you're interested in the properties of the system at very long distances, much larger than the microscopic scales involved, what you find is that the behavior of physical observables, like correlation functions, are identical in the two systems. I mean, in statistical mechanics, this is measured in terms of critical exponents that tell you how magnetization, density, susceptibility, and so on, behave as a function of the distance. What you find is that these two systems, even though they're very different, they have the same scaling behavior. And you may wonder, what's the rationale because of that? And the rationale behind that is exactly this, that even though the systems at short distances are completely different, they have different Hamiltonians, but they have the same symmetries, that's the point. And if you're interested at very large distances, the details of what happened at very short distances, whether you had an Ising Hamiltonian or some microscopic Hamiltonian for the water, doesn't matter. At very large distances, all that matters is that the most general interaction at large energies is encoded by these relevant interactions. And therefore, these systems are described by the same low energy field theory. And this, the randomization group essentially gives a first principles understanding of what had been observed in statistical mechanics under the notion of universality, which is this idea that completely different physical systems have the same behavior at large distances, which sounded very mysterious. But from this point of view, it's kind of obvious. It couldn't have been anything else, because at large distances, a system that has the same set of degrees of freedom and the same symmetries will be described as some low energy Lagrangian. So in this example, for example, that I mentioned, you want to describe a magnet at large distances, phi will correspond, I think I mentioned that already, to magnetization. And for the water gas transition, phi will describe the density. But if you want to understand the large distance behavior of magnetization or density, they'll be described by exactly the same low energy effective field theory, which is a very powerful statement. So if you go to the tables of data for critical exponents of systems that don't look at all like each other, you will find that they have essentially the same critical exponents. And this is the rationale behind it. Okay. Any questions? When did it start? I started late, I think. So I'll go on a little bit more. So let's make this a little bit more concrete. By that, I mean the fact that there are a finite number, given a set of degrees of freedom, there's a finite number of relevant interactions that dominate the low energy physics. And let's consider the simplest possible case, which is a system that, again, can have an arbitrarily complicated microscopic Hamiltonian or a non-Hamiltonian in general, because we don't know what happens at arbitrary short distances, but that is described at large distances by some macroscopic variable, which is a scalar field phi. And I already, well, here are two examples of two such systems. Let's describe the low energy behavior of magnetization and density from the point of view of a large distance behavior. And we don't care about what the microscopic Hamiltonian of these systems were. And so here we have this picture of the Lagrangian plus all relevant interactions. Let me just remind you that the S naught. So here I'm going to study the properties of the operators near what's called a Gaussian fixed point. So we'll start from a theory that's conformal invariant, which is just the free field theory. Okay, and now we want to study what happens when we perturb this free field theory, or Gaussian fixed point. That's a jargon. Imagine this is a Gaussian fixed point, where all couplings are zero. Okay. And now I want to study the behavior of the system as I perturb away from the fixed point. Okay. So the first thing that you know and love is that let's do some naive dimensional analysis to make the point that I want to make. The dimension of phi is just d minus 2 over 2, right? And now, essentially, what I want to write down is the most general interactions using that philosophy that I explained there. And just for fun and for simplicity, there's no huge simplicity, but let's assume that the system has a discrete symmetry under phi going to minus phi. Okay. So under this philosophy of that of the normalization group, which tells you that anything that can happen will happen, we have to write down all possible interactions that are consistent, that you can make out of a single scalar field and that are Z2 symmetric. So what are the kind of interactions you can have? You can have phi square, you can have phi cube, also phi cube, no. Phi to the fourth. Okay, forget about this discrete symmetry. So we have phi to the fourth and so on. What kind of other interactions can I add? Excuse me? That can always be redefined away by a shift of variables. But if you want, I can put it there. That's not a problem. That's not what I was looking for.
Then we can have some combination with the root.
So give me an example.
There's an index
floating around.
We don't have dimify square.
Okay, good. Yeah. So the point here is that you apart from these interactions, the potential interactions, you can have derivative interactions. So you can have things like this. You can have things like that. You can go nuts. Of course, I think that's important is that precisely because the theory is Lorentz invariant, derivatives always have to come in pairs because otherwise you'll have a floating index. But you will have things like this, for example, so on. So you can list, for a scalar field, you can either have potential interactions or derivative interactions. These are guys are called usually higher derivative interactions because they have more derivatives. Okay. And now, essentially, what we want to do is classify, given that we know the naive engineering dimension of phi, we want to list, make a complete list of what are the relevant operators that can exist in the various dimensions.
Okay, so
yes.
I don't see what would be the picture of a physical system that has this derivative interaction.
Oh, so imagine they're there. I mean, imagine you start with your favorite Lagrangian. What's your favorite Lagrangian? Like, imagine you start with lambda phi to the 4.
Okay.
Even if you don't want it, quantum effects would generate terms like this for you. So let me try to make it precise. So one thing is, that's why in this philosophy, you should start from the beginning with a more general interaction, because even though you imagine you start from just a very restricted set of interactions, like just lambda phi to the 4. The point of the normalization group is that even though you started with, say, the coupling of this operator being 0, quantum effects will generate a non-trivial term like that in the Lorentz effective action. So let me give you an example of that. Let me give you an example. Imagine you start with lambda phi to the 4. I want to show you that quantum mechanically, you'll generate an interaction which is of the type phi to the 6, say. Even though originally phi to the 6 did not appear in the interaction, it was generated through the quantum dynamics. So the way to see that, for example, I think I chose a complicated example, so let's see. So. Let me do this. From phi cubed, imagine I start with lambda phi cubed, and I want to generate a phi to the fourth interaction. So, awesome. Making a mess. So these are phi cubed interactions, right? You have trivial and vertex, trivial and vertex. So even though originally I had only this interaction, I have this, using Feynman diagrams, I can generate by having a virtual process here exactly a phi to the fourth term. There is a non-trivial four-point function that is acquired due to this virtual process. Another way of saying it more, if you want, I can try to say it more precisely. Is this sufficient? Or?
No, I was originally asking.
It doesn't matter. I mean, this guy just means that when you compute this process, this guy will have a non-trivial momentum dependent. So this amplitude in general is a function. So imagine you have momentum 1, 2, 3, 4. So you need to define this Mandelstam variable. You have momentum flowing here, Lorentz invariance tells you that the amplitude will have to be a function of the Lorentz invariance, which are S, T, and U. Are you familiar with this, with the Mandelson variable? Okay. So that tells you that this amplitude just by Lorentz invariance will have to be a function of S, T, and U. And in general, this function has a power series expansion in S, T, and U. And the variation in this expansion, if you replace momentum with derivative, you precisely get. Maybe we should do an exercise to, for example, show, maybe I'll try to come with some tutorial where starting with a simple Lagrangian, how to generate a higher derivative term by integrating it out. But that's kind of really the heart of that philosophy there, that even though you say, okay, my theory only has lambda phi to the fourth, I don't care about anything else, that's a lie, because quantum mechanics will generate for you all possible interactions. What will happen, of course, is that most of them will not be important at low energy. But fundamentally, you should really allow for all coupling and just see how all coupling works.
Is there anything stopping you from introducing some kind of constant tensor field and then coupling derivatives to this tensor field?
Well, that would be a great environment.
It would?
Yeah. I mean, you don't have a quantum field? Yes.
Yeah. Why?
Well, if the background field, is it a vector or a scalar?
It's some tensor field.
Well, if it's a tensor, then it will regularly vary. The expectation value of, say, A mu, A mu is a vector, is not invariant in the Lorentz transformation.
Okay.
Okay, so we were classifying. We're classifying what are the the relevant interactions in this scalar field theory. Let's first in six dimensions. Okay. So first of all, notice that Lorentz invariants. So first of all, this guy already by definition has dimension d. Right? That's how we obtain that phi has dimension d minus 2/2. Hopefully I don't have to go through that. You know how to do that. Now, let's first get out of the way those guys. It is clear. So now we're looking for operators or interactions that have a dimension which is smaller than D. That's what somewhere here. Operators that have dimension less than D. But notice that since the theory has to be Lorentz invariant, you always need at least two derivatives, okay? So any term that you try to write down, it will immediately have more than dimension d. Take, for example, this example. This guy, if I didn't have phi, this guy already had dimension d, right? That's how it was constructed. So if I add another phi, you already pass the bound. So this guy will be relevant. So essentially, all these interactions will be irrelevant. Because the dimension is bigger than this. Is this point clear? It should be clear. Because the point to remember is that the derivative costs you one unit of dimension. Because derivative is like momentum. Momentum has units of energy and gives you one unit of dimension. So if you have a theory with only a scalar field, a single scalar field, the higher derivative interactions, these terms are irrelevant. If you have a richer theory where you have a scalar field coupled to a Gauss field, you can have derivative interactions that are still marginal. But if you only have a scalar field, all higher derivative terms are irrelevant. So already, in one shot, we've killed an infinite family of interactions that are there, but that are not important at low energy. So we can, for a very large distance process, we can ignore them, essentially. Now, in six dimensions, so now we have to fish for relevant operators here. So can someone tell me what are the relevant operators in six dimensions that you can construct out of phi?
Sorry?
D squared?
Phi cubed? No, it's a
matter of. Yeah, so but let me put it. So this is relevant. this is classically marginal. And now you have to, in order to decide whether it is, so something that's classically marginal can change its character quantum mechanically. It can either become relevant or irrelevant. For that, you have to study its quantum dynamics. And for this particular case, what happens is that the phi cubed interaction, as you know, becomes weak at large distances. So that means that it becomes irrelevant. And the fancy word for saying this, when a coupling is marginal, but quantum mechanically it becomes irrelevant, is the name marginally irrelevant. But for that, it's not something that you can just do dimensional analysis. Essentially, you have to exactly study the beta function. You have to study the one loop running of the theory. Yes, sorry.
Can quantum dynamics change the state from irrelevant to relevant in general? It classifies them classically as irrelevant, all the derivatives.
There are some examples. There are some exotic examples where something that was irrelevant in the UV can become relevant in the infrared. So we want to be careful. Yes. In general, it's very hard to determine that. So, but in theory, have supersymmetry. There are enough constraints that you can actually decide whether something that was irrelevant can become relevant. But generally, that doesn't really happen. So, anything else here? Okay. What about in four dimensions? Now let's go to the other interesting case, d equals 2. So what are the marginal, what are the relevant operators here? All of them, okay. And this is an important point, that as we decrease the dimension of your system, the dimension of phi becomes smaller, classically, and therefore there are more and more interactions that become. And there is the extreme case of two dimensions where an arbitrary potential becomes relevant. Okay. The reason that this is important, and the fact that this is true, namely that around the Gaussian fixed point, any deformation that you add is relevant, is really behind the fact that in two dimensions, there is a rich landscape of conformal field theories. And the reason behind that is the following, is that if you, and that's not so much in higher dimensions. So conformal field theories like to live in lower dimensions for the reason I'll explain now. And I think I'll stop with that. Essentially, what happens is that relevant operators can generate flows. Between fixed points. Or conformal field theories. So, as I said, just vectorially, a relevant direction was a direction in the space, in the flow direction that kicked you away from the original fixed point. And typically what's going to happen is that you sit at a fixed point, you turn a relevant operator that kicks you away from the fixed point, but you land in another fixed point. So you start with a fixed point here. So imagine you start with a Gaussian, and this is a very relevant example in condensed matter physics. Imagine you started with a Gaussian fixed point. Now you turn on some relevant operator, you can generate a flow to a different fixed point. Okay? And this, since now the value of the coupling here is definitely not zero, we call this a non-trivial fixed point. So in this respect, the relevant operators are much more interesting than irrelevant operators, because since relevant operators, remember, are things that flow towards the fixed point here, they cannot map you from that fixed point to a different fixed point. Well, relevant operators can really generate flow from one fixed point to a different fixed point. Okay? And that's why, in two dimensions, where essentially you can have arbitrary, so in this space, if you're in the Gaussian fixed point, there's an infinite number of directions you can move, and you can fish from any fixed point. And that's where the richness of two-dimensional conformal field theory comes from. Yes?
But then, when you fix point, the relevant becomes irrelevant.
Yes. That's right, yes. And this example actually is very important. So an example of this flow, I don't have time for that. Just very quickly, I'll try to explain it maybe more detail next time. It's something that describes actually critical phenomena. So second order phase transitions in two and three dimensions, and goes under the name, you might have seen this in your courses, I don't know. If not, let me know. It's called the Wilson-Fisher fixed points. And this, the critical behavior of magnetization, density, blah, 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 near this fixed point that you have to calculate, because this is a now non-trivial fixed point, determines the behavior of second order phase transitions in magnets, for example. Okay. So I think it's probably better that I stop and I'll continue next time.
A question?
Yes.
I see that these irrelevant operators are not important for a Gaussian fixed point. This is here, but how about non trivial fixed points?
Well, then you have to worry about that. It is hard to study it directly, because unless you're in a situation like this, where in some sense the value of the coupling, typically we only have access to perturbation theory, unless you have supersymmetry, something like this, that gives you more powerful constraints that you can go beyond perturbation theory. Typically you can only study perturbation theory. And so that means that the fixed point that you can study reliably in perturbation theory are points where this guy is very close to this guy. Okay. And then near that fixed point, you can study whether the interactions near that fixed point are relevant or irrelevant. But if you are very far away, it's very hard to determine whether it's an operator is relevant or irrelevant. And then you need other techniques to do it. If you're using a technique, for example, supersymmetry gives you a lot of constraints that allow you to determine the exact dimension of operators far away fixed point and determine whether it's irrelevant or relevant.
Okay.
Okay, we'll continue tomorrow.